Thank you, Mr. Smith. Good afternoon to all. Pass on greetings from your sister congregation in Meadville this morning. And a beautiful day for a drive back and forth. We had the chance to spend some time in the area visiting with members over there yesterday and then began the service there with 10 o'clock this morning. I think we all are going to get the impression from today that the fall holy day season is just about to begin. I think we're going to find some similarities in topic material, in some selections, a different approach, different angle, but I don't think we'll be able to mistake what our season is. You know, most of us, I'm sure, have interests in addition to the marvelous calling that God has given us. And that's fine, that's healthy. Those interests can range from the artistic to the sporting world, to crafts and skills, to handicrafts, to collections of various sorts, to history, to various types of reading and the researching into different topics, you name it. The list could go on and on of various interests that we as individual people have. And again, that's healthy. What I think is even more special is when our outside interests, if we can call them that, can coincide with elements of God's plan and calling and give it extra focus. To when we're able to analyze things that draw our attention in which we are interested and we're able to connect them to the purpose God has for us, to feel and see how they can dovetail and amplify and simply show us the rightness of God's purpose and His plan, and show us just how accurate it is because it all fits together into a pattern. Of course, what's dangerous, and this is something that probably most of us have in one way or another when we came into God's truth, especially if we did not grow up in it, what's dangerous is when those interests actually clash with God's way of life, where they don't mesh. You know, for example, suppose you didn't know anything about the Church of God and you just loved collecting Halloween memorabilia when you came in the church. You're going to have a small problem with that, aren't you? When you come into the church, when you know the truth of God's way and you realize where those things fit. So there are, and that's, you know, that's relatively, you might say, benign because that's easy. You know, you call the refuse company and say, well, be a little big extra pickup on the curb today, and there it goes, and you're set. What's dangerous is when those interests clash with God's way of life, leading us into perilous or even sinful situations. That can be troubling and difficult. Today, as we know, and you've already heard, we stand really on the brink of the fall festival season. Trumpets is only a week away from Monday. We're 9 days away. And that's in a year where, although it's always the same on God's calendar, the Feast of Trumpets is always the first day of the seventh month. We know that because of the difference in the calendars. This year it falls later on the Roman calendar that we use. Everything's in October this year. You know, for example, a few years ago, I remember 3 years ago in 2013 was the earliest I can ever recall keeping the holy days. This date 3 years ago would have been day six of the Feast of Tabernacles. We were almost done. It was just one of those years where it came extremely early and everything was in September and you could have been home and, you know, back in your area before October 1st ever got here. And then 1 week from today will be October the 1st, the first Sabbath in October, and 2 days later we'll be into the Feast of Trumpets. What interests you at this time of year? Whatever it is, does it draw you closer to God's plan and His purpose and more in harmony with His way of thinking? Or dangerously away from it? Does this world and this society seem sometimes more our home than the future that God holds out to us? I hope that that's not the case. These fall holy days, brethren, every year can give us a chance to reorient ourselves, to restructure, to reprogram, to rethink, to remember where we really fit in. That's true of all God's holy days, but the fall holy days have an extra special quality to them in that they're all prophetic. They are all about events that have not yet taken place. And so it's like we're given a warning ahead of time. Mr. Pavlik gave us lots of, you know, ahead of time warning. 9 more days till the Feast of Trumpets, as he pointed out. Piece of cake. We got all this stuff worked out in the next week and 2 days. But God's holy days do that for us. They give us a chance to rethink, reorient, reprogram. And I'd like to take some time today, in the time remaining with this second split sermon, to look at a concept that we should be very familiar with at this time of the year. It especially applies to the Feast of Tabernacles. I certainly don't want to skip over the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement. Again, the first split sermon gave us the opportunity to make sure we don't do that. And the Day of Atonement, while it may be the day when we are the most physically uncomfortable, I find for me in recent years has begun to grow in my appreciation and awareness and understanding of the need for it just more and more every year because of what it pictures. We do so desperately in this world need the binding of Satan the devil. We so desperately need him restrained and unable to influence humanity anymore. That is a beautiful day. Even if as you sit there in services, your stomach is growling as you listen to the service on atonement. What's worse is when you're up here speaking and the microphone can pick up your stomach growling as you're trying to speak to people. But it's a beautiful day and a beautiful meaning. But what I want to talk about today really ties in much more directly to the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's the idea of being a pilgrim. Being a pilgrim. A stranger. A wanderer. A wayfarer. It's a topic that's not unfamiliar to us. You're familiar with the biblical reference, I know, in Hebrews chapter 11. That's where we'll begin today. Hebrews 11, we'll start in verse number 8. We know that the entire chapter is a recounting of some of the lives of those faithful servants of God over the ages. And in verse 8 it says, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would afterward receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. If he had asked for more specific directions, he might not have received any further answer." It's a matter of faith and of trust in God. This is the faith chapter, after all. If he had asked and said, "Where do you want me to go?" the answer might have been, "I will reveal that to you en route." In which case, he would have said, "Okay, just point me in the direction then that you want me to go." By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Think about that. This is Abraham we're talking about. You and I have some grasp of what he's talking about. The writer of Hebrews, probably Paul, when he says, the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. We know what he means. The New Jerusalem. How far in the future was that for Abraham? Thousands of years. Thousands of years. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. Having just had the opportunity not so long ago to stand on the seashore, I couldn't even begin to try to think of counting the grains of sand. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. Familiar verses from the chapter of the faithful. We know the wording. There are three words here that I would like to have you really catch as we move forward. The first one is in verse 9, where it says, about Abraham, by faith he sojourned. That's the word. Sojourned. The other two words are both in verse 13. And it talks about those who died in faith, having not received the promises yet, after listing some of their qualities and viewing them, it says that they confessed. Now, you know what it means to confess. Confess means to own up to admit to. You know, if you confess, and when you were a little kid, if your parents came to you and said, you know, there are too many cookies gone from the cookie jar. And after you got done trying to blame your brother for it, present company accepted. Finally, if you confessed, what you did was you admitted, okay, I took the cookies from the cookie jar. These people admit. They own up to the fact that they are strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Those are the two words. Strangers. Pilgrims. I'd like to add one more word for your thought process. The word is exile. Exile. 5 years ago, in 2011, a book was published that intrigues me. I have not yet read it. I've got a lot of books at home that I have read. I don't even possess this one yet, but I'll get around to it. Let me just check it out of the library. But the idea intrigues me. The subject relates to our topic today. The title was The Cypress Tree, A Love Letter to Iran. The author was a woman born in Iran in 1970. Her name is Kamin Mohammadi. Kamin Mohammadi, K-A-M-I-N-M-O-H-A-M-M-A-D-I. Kamin Mohammadi. Here's a description of the book from the website Amazon.com, followed, and I'll give you a bit of a brief synopsis of a few book critics' comments after reviewing the book. But here's the description from Amazon. Kamin Mohammadi was 9 years old when her family fled Iran during the 1979 revolution. Bewildered by the seismic changes in her homeland, she turned her back on the past and spent her teenage years trying to fit in with British attitudes to family, food, and freedom. Her family fled to England for refuge. She was 27 before she returned to Iran. Drawn inexorably back by memories of her grandmother's house in Abadan, with its traditional inner courtyard, its noisy gatherings, and its very walls steeped in history. The Cypress Tree, A Love Letter to Iran, is Kamin's account of her journey home, to rediscover her Iranian self, and to discover for the first time the story of her family, a sprawling clan that sprang from humble roots to bloom during the affluent, biba-clad 1960s, only to be shaken by the horrors of the Iran-Iraq War and the heartbreak of exile, and toughened by the struggle for democracy that continues today. This moving and passionate memoir is a love letter both to Kamin's extraordinary family and to Iran itself, the ancient country of Persia, which has survived so much modern tumult, but where joy and resilience will always triumph over despair. That's the summary of the book. A couple of the reviewers said these things. The heartfelt tale of a family shaped by the tumultuous drama of 20th century Iran. The Cypress Tree is a profoundly affecting meditation on the shattering experience of exile. Another reviewer. The Cypress Tree is vivid testimony to Kamin Mohammadi's ebullient, irrepressible family, whose courage to endure carries them through revolution, exile, and return to triumphant survival. Devoid of self-pity and full of grace, the Mohammadi family motto might as well be, "Whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger." One brief comment, another reviewer just said, "A memoir to inspire." I think it might be an interesting read. Did you notice that extra word I gave you appeared twice in the comments by the critics and once in the description by Amazon.com? The word was exile. Exile. Let's take a look at a biblical reference to four other exiles in Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, you probably know from hearing in various sermons over the years or Bible studies, or perhaps you haven't recalled it or it's new to you, but the Babylonian or Chaldean, as it was also known, destruction or conquest of the southern kingdom of Judah happened over a succeeding period of waves of attack. It wasn't all carried out immediately in one fell swoop. It occurred over a series of attacks spanning a number of years. But we feel that probably the best accurate date we can come up with is somewhere around 586 BC, the city finally completely fell to the Babylonians, although they had probably been attacking for nearly 20 years before that. Daniel and his friends were taken captive in one of those earlier waves of assault. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. And then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach, or to whom they might teach, the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision, so this was a budgeted expense, I guess we'd say, of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them. That's pretty extensive. By the time you eliminate breaks, summer breaks, winter breaks, spring breaks, and so on, that's probably about the length of time of a fairly typical bachelor's degree program in our country, in our culture now, for a college degree. 3 years of training, if, like I said, if you remove all the breaks from the college experience. 3 years of training for them so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. This was the plan. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were these four: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave them Babylonian names. Those were their Hebrew names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah he called him Shadrach. To Mishael he became Meshach. And Azariah became Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. I won't go any further into the account now, but it did work out. There was some concern about it, that they might start looking poorly, as they say in the south, but that Daniel said, be reassured, we'll be fine. And they looked healthier than the others. But Daniel's purpose was clear. We don't know all the details about why it was. We don't know whether they served mostly unclean food. We don't know what the problem was specifically with this proposed diet. But it was symbolic as much as it was literal. Daniel refused to defile himself, and we presume his three companions as well, either physically or spiritually, with the culture of the Chaldeans to which they had been brought. What do you and I have in common with these four young exiles? What can we learn from considering a story such as that of Kamin Mohammadi, ripped from her own experience and homeland and life that she knew and loved at the age of 9, coming home much, much later to experience it again at the age of 27. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. You're going to find some familiar words here. Verse 11, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims," heard those words before? "Abstain," interesting word after thinking about what Daniel did, "abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they behold and observe," think of the first sermon today, the first split sermon, "glorify God in the day of visitation, in the day that He begins to work with them." 1 Peter 2, verses 11 and 12. Familiar verses. And we see the words again, sojourners and pilgrims. A sojourner is a foreigner, an outsider, a pilgrim, a traveler, a wayfarer. Pilgrims, another word, similar meanings, someone who's just passing through. You know, we hear the word actually mentioning the young lady from Iran, of course, in connection with the Islamic faith and belief system. They have what they believe are required pilgrimages during the lifetime of an individual, right? You're familiar with that. They're supposed to take a pilgrimage to the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina during their lifetime. If you go back in our own history, American history, the group that we refer to as the Pilgrims, do you realize that many of them did not just come straight from England to this country? There were a number who first immigrated to the Netherlands because they found that they could more peacefully exist and practice their beliefs, which were separate from the established church in England and the Netherlands. But things were not as good there as they'd hoped, and they eventually decided to relocate to this country, to the New World. So they too were in a process of passing through. A pilgrim is one who is on a journey, someone who is traveling to a different location, someone who is just passing through. And those are thoughts for us. You know, when you compare that and the word abstain here in verse 11 of 1 Peter 2, and we think about Daniel and his determination not to defile himself with the culture that he found himself surrounded by in Babylon. Question for us. Do I refuse to defile myself with a culture that is not God's? You know, looking ahead to the Feast of Tabernacles, it's not that far away. It comes just 2 weeks after the Feast of Trumpets, as I'm sure we all are aware. And we will have a brief respite from this world. We talk about coming out of the world at the feast. It's a remarkable experience. Those of us who've done it so many times, it just becomes the highlight of the year, doesn't it? This will be my 56th Feast of Tabernacles. I'm not quite sure how that many have come and gone, but they have. And they're all amazing. You and I will have a brief respite during the feast, a time that we can come out of this society and this culture, which we should have the impression doesn't quite fit into our true homeland. Those of you who were here shortly after the feast last year may recall a guest sermonette we had given here by somebody named, what was his name? Johnson, Rich Johnson, somebody named Johnson. And he talked about, in the concept of the sermonette, how we were all told, you know, we'd be leaving the feast soon, traveling home. But he said, in so many ways, we left home. When we left the feast, we left our true home. That is our true home. That is our culture. That is our way of life. God's way of life. And so we'll have a brief respite from this culture. But always, every year, it goes all too quickly. It goes all too quickly. I recall the time many years ago sitting down at the opening night of a feast service, and it just hit me so strongly. I don't know why that year above all other years, but I turned to my wife and I said, "It's almost over." And it was the opening night. And she looked at me with this really strange look and she said, "But it's the first night." I said, "Exactly. It's almost over." It goes so fast. The opening night starts and then you turn around and somebody is up there saying, "This is day 7 of the feast, but folks, don't go home yet. There's one more day to follow, a separate festival, the last great day, the 8th day. Don't leave yet." And it's gone. And we go back into the world as pilgrims one more time. Strangers again. Leaving our home. And going back to a culture that increasingly feels more and more alien. When you look at the verses in Hebrews once again, Hebrews 11, let's take a look at them, a little more detailed look. In verse 13 of Hebrews 11, there's emphasis placed here on the status of the faithful. This is the chapter of the faithful. And the emphasis here is placed on who they really are and what they really are. It says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, they were assured of them." There were no doubts. They were assured of the promises. They embraced them and they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They had a clear focus of what their role was. They were not permanent in the countries and the cultures and the lands in which they lived. They were strangers. They were pilgrims. Literally, it says in verse 9 that Abraham sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country. Did you catch what that means? This was the land that was promised to him and his descendants. And he was dwelling there like a person in a foreign country. He was a pilgrim. He was a stranger. They all resisted, these people, the faithful people in this chapter, they all resisted being absorbed into the culture of their times. That's important. Question for you and for me. Do I resist being absorbed into the culture of my time? Do I realize that I am a stranger here? I am a pilgrim here. Brethren, you realize that even those who profess to be Christian in our world believe they are part of this system. They talk about working within the system. They talk about, in this case, in our land, trying to elect certain officials who will put their goals forward. And while there might be some sense of agreement over some of the things that ought to change in our country, there's a vast difference in our idea of the solution to the problem. We do not believe the solution lies in the hands of human beings. We have proven to our satisfaction that human beings don't have the answer. It hasn't been proven yet to the satisfaction of the population of the earth. That remains yet ahead, terribly, in the time called the Great Tribulation. But you and I know that it has been demonstrated to us beyond a shadow of a doubt that the answer does not lie with humankind. Have you and I resisted being absorbed into the culture of our times? These people, we find, held God's promises as something real. It says in verse 13, they had died in the faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Isn't that true for us too? Jesus Christ has not yet returned. One day He will. As I've said so many times, there will be a morning. There will come a morning when the sun rises that morning, and before it sets that night, He will have set foot on the Mount of Olives. He will be here. It will be a real day in the history of this planet. It isn't yet here. There will be a day in the history of this planet when the sun rises and Satan is still given free range. And before the sun sets that night, he will have been bound. It will be a real day in the history of our planet. God's promises, they said, were real. They were assured of them. They embraced them. And they confessed that what that meant in their lives was that they were pilgrims and strangers here. This was not their world. This was not their homeland. They were like Kamin Mohammadi in exile, ripped from her family's experience. Are God's promises real to me? We can ask that. These promises we find in the chapter of the faithful motivated them to live their lives in a certain way. Motivated them to be different than they would otherwise have been. Prompted changes from the usual patterns. Question: do God's promises do that for me? Their faith that these promises were from God never wavered. It says they were assured of them. To be assured means you are certain. Means all shadow of doubt has been removed. It has been proven to your satisfaction. This is the way it is. You are assured of a certain thing. We move on to verse 14. And it says, for those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. You know what this essentially says? It essentially says we don't fit here. We are looking for something else. We have assessed the situation. We have looked all around us. And our conclusion is, this is not my homeland. This is not my culture. I don't mean that we say, you know, we reject citizenship, we refuse to respect the flag, we refuse to be good citizens, we speed when we want to, we disregard. No, none of that. Just the opposite, in fact. We are good citizens. We are law-abiding. We keep the laws of the land to be good and responsible examples. The only contrast coming if they contradict God's laws, which is rare, thankfully. But what it says here in verse 14 is once we become comfortable with our status, which we found in verse 13, we have confessed, we have admitted, we have owned up to the fact that we are strangers and pilgrims. Once we become comfortable with that status and recognize who we are, then we can plainly declare by our lives, as you heard Mr. Pavlik say, that we have another homeland. We seek another culture. We seek another way. We are here with another solution. God's solution. The return of His Son, the King. That's our solution. God's solution. We're on a journey here. We're just passing through. Verse 15. It says, and truly, If they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. What do I focus on? Which homeland is mine? What do I see as I look around me? Do I get caught up in the squabbles and the tussles and the battles and the issues and the focuses and the concerns and the politics and all that stuff of this world? If I do, I'm not seeing something. I'm missing something, desperately missing something. Which land is mine? Remember the Israelites, what happened to them? You know, they came out with a high hand, all the plagues that were rained down on Egypt, they were sprung free. They were free after generations. What happened when they hit the wilderness and problems started? Murmur, 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 murmur. What was one of the common refrains? Oh, that we could go back to Egypt. Oh, I remember the leeks and the cucumbers and the flesh pots and the long days of slavery and the fact we couldn't even have straw provided to make our bread. No, I didn't remember that part. They remembered all the plenty they claimed to have in Egypt. They rewrote their history in their minds. They wanted to go back. And at one point, after the spies had brought back an evil report, 10 of the spies had, you know, knock-kneed approach, weak-kneed approach, and said, they're too big, we're like grasshoppers, they were squishing us and stomping on us, and it was terrible, and we will never survive, you know, crank out the lower lip, woe is us. Joshua and Caleb said, we are well able to overcome them. Our God is with us. And then they had a change of heart. Well, no, okay, now we're going to appoint a leader. And no, God said, too late. But they wanted to go back to Egypt. That was their sentiment. What about Lot's wife? A similar sentiment. The angels thrust Lot and his wife and two daughters out of the city of Sodom, and she wanted to go back. I don't think it was just a quick backward glance. What's happening back there? The impression was that she wanted to go back. She turned back. Question for me. Do I look back? Because if I do, I could be drawn back. It says in verse 15, if they had called to mind, if truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. If you want to go back to the world, God says, you'll find a way. You'll find a way. God's kingdom is not yet here. The images we have in our minds as we attend the Feast of Tabernacles, of the millennial reign of Christ, the first job for the newly born children, spirit children of the family of God, all those images, it's not yet here. You and I will have to go back. But brethren, and just like that happens at the Feast of Tabernacles every year, we have to go back to the world. We come before God. We say, this is my true homeland. It goes so fast. I don't want to leave. Can we keep another 8 days, please? You know, maybe your second tithe has run out by then, but still wish I didn't have to go back home. It's a special time. But though we have to go back into the world as representatives of this other culture, we must not become immersed in this culture. We have to learn the lesson of Daniel and the exiles. Our status is that of strangers and pilgrims. Verse 13. I'm just passing through. We are to be the salt and the light, Jesus Christ said in the Sermon on the Mount. We're to be an example of what he's doing here below. You heard some of that in the first sermon as well. What God can accomplish through us, Mr. Pavlik so illuminatingly said, through the likes of us. That's the example. We are representatives of another culture, another government, another kingdom. That's who we are. You know, it's interesting, as you read verse 16, there's an A key word in verse 16, and you've heard me preach enough sermons and draw attention to it enough times in the scripture. If you just read through verse 16, what key word am I thinking about? Pretty much smack in the middle of that verse. Well, the word, as you no doubt thought of, is therefore. Therefore. How many times do we read that in the scripture? And it's a connecting word. What it tells us is what you just heard before this word influences what comes after it. Because of what I just said, here's the condition that now exists. It's a connector. And here's what it says. But now it says, in other words, in contrast to the people who would have found a way back to the worldly culture if they wanted to, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, is it too much to say? Because they have that right desire for a different homeland. They're looking for a different culture. They are representatives of a different kingdom. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. Now, if that's what therefore means in this verse, let's do a little language construction and deconstruction here. What happens if you have one of these statements where you have a statement and then the connecting word therefore, which shows that what follows is based on, predicated on what went before the therefore? What happens if you change the premise up above the therefore? Don't you change the result that comes after? So if the statement is, but now they desire a better, that is a heavenly country, therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. Does that imply that if we don't really desire the better and the heavenly country, does that imply God is ashamed to view us that way? That's a scary thought, isn't it? That is a scary thought. That's something to think about, something to consider. Just passing through. That's you and that's me. We know, it says here, He has prepared a city for them. We know what that is. I've spoken on that before too. It's Zion, or sometimes called Mount Zion. It's the new Jerusalem eventually. The one that God is building and constructing and preparing where He lives now. The one that won't even make its appearance on this earth until way after the events that are described in the Bible occur. On beyond the millennial reign of Christ. On beyond the great or second resurrection, on beyond the great white throne judgment where those who never lived and died are given their chance, on beyond the destruction of the surface of this earth via the lake of fire, then the new heavens and the new earth come down from God. That's what we're looking for. That's our city. That's our true home. You know, we've read them. There are Psalms where God talks about that. When He says, this one was born there. That's where you're from. That's your citizenship. That's where you belong. He has prepared that city, and we know where it is. It's our hometown, too. Are we willing, brethren, to embrace these titles? Stranger. Wayfarer. Pilgrim. Traveler. Exile. And do we live life accordingly? What is real to us? And what is temporary and illusory? We have to ask those questions. Turn to Philippians chapter 2. These are all things to consider as we head into the great fall holy day season. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. certainly has some overtones to ancient Israel. It says, do all things without murmuring and disputing. That sounds a lot like ancient Israel. And then he says that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Mr. Pavlik talked to us about that, about how we can be lights in some of the smallest ways that we may not even credit as being anything different, but people do sometimes notice. We need to be in a spot, brethren, where we never get so comfortable in the land in which we live that we forget our true status. And again, I'll say them: wayfarer, pilgrim, wanderer, stranger, exile. I'm just passing through. This is not my homeland. This is not my culture. I am a light of the way of God. I am the salt of the earth by His help and His power and His strength and His Spirit. I am a pilgrim. I am a stranger. I look for a better world. As Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, I avoid being defiled by the culture around me. I am just passing through. I will be an example of God's way to the best of my ability. I will be aware of Galatians 6 and do, it says, do good to all as you have the opportunity. It does go on to say, chiefly those, especially those of the household of faith. We have opportunities to show what it is like to be a godly person. Do we remember our status as we head into the fall holy day season? Stranger, pilgrim, wanderer, wayfarer, exile. Eventually, that which we look for will be here. Turn to Revelation 21. Revelation 21 and verse 1. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. The first of what are a total comes to a total of seven no mores in Revelation 21 and 22. I know I've given a sermon on that before. I got a great idea from an old friend of mine. We actually went to high school together. Britton Taylor and I were in the same high school in Kansas City, Missouri, years ago. He gave a sermon at the feast in Corpus Christi 5 years ago entitled The Seven No Mores. And I, you know, in typical ministerial fashion, I plagiarized it and gave it myself here. But I did tell you where I got it. It's from my friend Britton Taylor. The Seven No Mores. Here's the first of them. No more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and here come four more of the no mores. There shall be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, no more pain, for the former things have passed away. And then He who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And He said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And He said, the strangers and the pilgrims' society has come. And He said, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. the New Jerusalem, Zion, our true homeland, our culture. But for now, stranger, exile, wanderer, pilgrim, and wayfarer.